Hi, this is Daniel Garber at the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Today I'm talking about a new multi-layered documentary that opens tonight at the Royal Cinema in Toronto called Puppet. It's about puppetry as a legitimate art form. Dan Herlin, an artist who uses puppets as his performance, and about the subject of a play Dan created about an eccentric outside artist from small town Depression-era Arkansas, who recreated himself as a persona named Dis Farmer. So I'm very pleased to have the director of this documentary this morning with me on telephone. Hi, David Saul.
Hi, Daniel.
This movie covers a lot of ground about the history of puppetry, from Japanese bunraku to Indonesian shadow puppets. Your film says puppetry was demoted to an oft-dismissed kids medium, something looked down on by legitimate theater. Why do you think this happened?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of theories about that. What's important to note is that that's an American phenomenon, American and, you know, maybe British also, but in most of the world, puppetry never was demoted in that way. It was high art, or it was religion, or it was folk art.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really an American and maybe English phenomenon that demoted puppetry to children's theater. And the theory that I like, personally, I'm not sure it's necessarily correct or true, but I find it useful, is that puppetry declined along with the ascendancy of realism, as naturalism in theater and in film and in the dramatic arts generally became the desired modus operandi. Puppetry naturally sort of was pushed out of that sphere because it's one thing puppets really can't do. And this is, in the film, this is articulated by Eileen Blumenthal and various other academics who have thought about this a lot more than I have. But the idea is that as science and technology and the Industrial Revolution took hold, people became less attached to the kind of magical thinking and mythological thinking that used to dominate.
So
in places, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so what is it that is causing this turnaround, sort of the re-legitimization, the re-emergence as a respected type of performance art in North America?
Sure, I think that's the million-dollar question. again, a few people in the film speculate about that. One of the puppeteers, Chris Green, who's been working in this medium and also is a kinetic artist, a kinetic sculptor, his theory, and again, this is sort of what I find most useful, is that it's a backlash against over-digitization, you know, a sort of yearning for the physical and the tactile, and, a backlash against everything being explained in a really thorough and complete way. So a desire at the same time to remystify the world, which I can relate to, while also pushing back against the sort of perfection of digital arts and sort of the feeling that you look at your iPhone and it just works and it's perfect and you can't take it apart, you can't understand the guts of it. So there's this urge to go back to sort of fixed gear bicycles and old-fashioned radios. It's part of, the return to puppetry is part of that larger trend away from, digital perfection.
So you could almost say the surreal is more real.
Sure, yeah. It feels somehow more original.
So what elements, like those used by Dan Herlin in the film, what are the elements that set it apart from traditional puppet shows?
You mean the work that Dan Herlin does?
Yeah. When I say different, I mean different from like a Punch and Judy or a kids puppet show. What does he do that's
different?
Sure.
Well, what got me interested in making this movie was seeing shows in the New York downtown sort of avant-garde theater. And what they're doing there is taking, for the last, it's a scene that's been coming together for about 30 years and really sort of hit its stride in the 90s around the Jim Henson International Festival, where they brought puppetry companies from Japan and from France and from Eastern Europe and Africa and so on, and exposed New York theater audiences and New York artists to all these different forms of puppetry they'd never seen before. And the scene that picked up that Dan Herlin is now a part of, he came out of dance and performance art, but now he's really part of this puppetry scene, is about taking these forms that have been developed over hundreds or thousands of years in places like Japan and Europe and doing what they want with them. So there are aspects of Dan's shows that are heavily influenced by Japanese bunraku theater, where you have a three-person system. Three puppeteers have their hands directly on one puppet, which is a form that's just, if you haven't seen it, it's sort of magical to behold, because you see these three operators with their hands directly on the puppet, and they're together able to create this unified subject that moves as if under its own power.
Dance style is different from bunraku in that you can see their face.
Yeah, that's true. In bunraku, usually you're only able to see the head puppeteer's face, or not even in the most traditional, not any of their faces. And Dan exposes their faces. He's incorporated elements of tabletop puppetry, where you put all the action on these tables. And he also has developed this form where he moves the tables around in their own choreography.
I was just going to say that was very beautiful, where the tables are moving with the puppets and as sort of part of the scenery, but also part of the puppetry.
Yeah, it's really something that's unique to Dan in a way, and other people have worked with similar forms with moving tables, but Dan has this background in dance and choreography before he got into puppetry and object theater that really lends itself to those sort of multi-layered kinetic choreographies. So he has, the tables are moving, the puppeteers are moving, and then there's the action and the story, which is centered around the puppet. And it's just such a rich aesthetic experience to be able to look through all those different layers of movement. And so he's really skilled at being able to play with that while also not overwhelming your senses. You still identify with the character, think about the character as a character abstracted from the movement.
Right.
So I think it's really special what he does.
I'm speaking with David Saul, the director of a new documentary called Puppet. In the movie, Dan Herlin puts on a show called Disfarmer?
That's right, yeah.
About an eccentric Depression-era outsider artist, a photographer. He's a really unusual character. What can you tell me about him?
Well, Mike Disfarmer was originally named Mike Meyer, and he owned a photography studio in the Depression era and before and after in rural Arkansas in a town called Heber Springs. And his eccentricity and, debatably his schizophrenia came out in different ways throughout his life. And one manifestation was his sudden legal changing of his name from Mike Meyer to Mike Disfarmer, to express his disgust and distaste for all the rural farmers that he lived with and that he photographed. And what's interesting about Mike Disfarmer isn't just that he was crazy. It's that his portrait photography, which was, again, just sort of workmanlike. He had a photo studio. He shot for whatever, a nickel, your portrait for you. Long after his life, his 3,000 glass plate negatives were discovered by the photography world. And they're gorgeous. They're absolutely stunning. And unlike almost anything else we have from that time. So long after his death, he started showing up in New York art galleries and in galleries in Europe and having really the second life as a praised artist, which was about as far from his life as you could get. So when Dan Herlin sort of stumbled across a book of his photographs and started looking and turning these pages and seeing these amazing faces captured in this really interesting, unusual way, these really blank expressions that really invited the audience to project onto them whatever you can bring to it yourself.
Dan created the puppets for the show, he made really, I mean, they didn't look like it was a human sitting there, but they seemed like living beings. They seemed real. And you see a lot of horror movies with evil puppets and marionettes attacking people. And as you mentioned in the movie, even though they're inanimate objects, a lot of people think of them as real living things. So I'm curious, what happens to puppets after a show finishes? Do they turn back from characters into objects again? Do they go to a special puppet cemetery? Like, what happens to them?
Yeah. It's probably different for every artist. I don't know any puppeteers who destroy their puppets. I'm sure there are some that just sort of discard them and say, once the show's over, the object is worthless. Dan certainly keeps his as artifacts of the work, but they're certainly not people. I mean, once the show is over, they're definitely objects again. It's sort of interesting, and this is something, you know, I tried to focus on briefly in the movie because it struck me watching it is that while they're performing the puppet, they're making it as living as it can be. And as soon as that's done, it's just an object. And it needs to be treated carefully because they don't want to dent it or scratch it. But it's not treated with any kind of reverence. It's not a living thing. But for an audience member watching it, the urge to identify and project life onto that inanimate object is so strong that as soon as the show's over, if you see them just sort of handling the puppet as they would a suitcase or a painting or something non-living, is a little bit taboo.
Huh.
And I found that fascinating.
Yeah. If there is a villain in your film, not in the play, I would say it's the potential power of the theater critic from the New York Times who can make or break a show on opening night with just a single review. So why is one person still that powerful despite the proliferation of critical media on, like, all over the place, online and papers, TV?
Man, you got me. I would love to know the answer to that question because the New York Times does still – the New York Times theater critics in particular still wields outsized power. And the way it expresses itself is through booking tour dates. I mean, if you put a show up that's sort of right on the bubble of being able to have a nice long touring life and go around the world or not, you know, you're not a famous artist, but you're sort of in the game, and the New York Times gives it a great review, you have a great shot at a really long life and a ton of audiences seeing it. If the New York Times pans it, that is the first review that any presenter looks at. Even if you send them a press packet with 100 great reviews from all these other reputable sources, before they book a show, they go to the nytimes.com and see what the Times thought of it. And I don't know why.
Huh. Well, thanks so much for speaking to me. David Saul's Puppet opens tonight at the Royal Cinema in Toronto, and I've been talking with David Saul.
Sure thing. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. This is Daniel Garber at the movies each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.